Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. First things first, a few program notes. Number one, upcoming guest on this program, Paul Ruttner, the drummer of a band called The Mumps. The Mumps' lead singer was a guy named Lance Loud, who was the star of what some people call the first reality television show ever. It aired on PBS. It was called The American Family, and it just chronicled this family in Southern California. And during the course of the filming, the couple got a divorce, and Lance came out as gay, and he starts this punk rock band and moves to New York, puts out some singles, and they sort of, you know, because of his odd reality show celebrity, they got some very interesting fans like Andy Warhol. It became a scene. So we'll talk to Paul Ruttner, drummer of that band, about they finally got their entire works released on CD, and just talk about the music and the kind of circus surrounding the career of that band. And then Steve Cropper, the guitar player of Booker T and the MGs, will be a guest on this program. Been trying to get him on the show for years. He's got a new album out, and luckily I was able to get him on. And looking forward to talking to him about all his incredible music he's been a part of. Should be super interesting. But let's talk about today's guest, Dean Friedman. My wife, it was her birthday the day this aired, and she is the person who said, you really should interview Dean Friedman. We both are fans of his, but I give her a shout-out just for sort of poking me and getting me to do this one. So this one's for her. Dean Friedman, super interesting guy, super intelligent, and just one of those one-of-a-kind singer-songwriters. Hard to pick just a few songs, so I do recommend you go listen to the catalog if this kind of sounds interesting to you. And then stay tuned when our conversation is over. This is very important because in 1979, Dean Friedman appeared at Uppsala College, which is the college that used to own the license for WFMU. It's now out of business, and if you go to East Orange, New Jersey, where Uppsala College used to be, you'll just see a bunch of condos. They've knocked the college down and built condos. But Dean was doing a concert there, and the afternoon before the show, he went to WFMU and appeared on Jim Price's program. And Jim was happy enough, kind enough and happy to send me a recording of that. And so what you're going to hear after I speak to Dean, you're going to hear Dean back in 1979 performing for Jim Price on WFMU all the way back then. So enjoy that. It's a podcast-only special. And thanks for listening. Email me, michaels@wfmu.org. And I don't know. Hope you're healthy. Hope you're good. Enjoy this. It's me and Dean Friedman, and then Dean Friedman back in 1979. All right. I think we have Dean Friedman on the telephone. Good morning, Dean. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing not so bad. You are born, I believe, and raised in Paramus, not open on Sundays, New Jersey. Is that correct?
Exactly. Although, despite the blue laws, they let me in. I believe rumor has it I was conceived somewhere in the Bronx.
Okay.
But I was born and bred in Paramus, New Jersey, home of shopping malls and the bowling alley there on Route 17, and also a place that was designated by Lady Bird Johnson as the winner of the Keep America Beautiful contest.
I did not know that. Amazing.
Yeah, she flew over the town in a helicopter. That's what I remember in my elementary school days at Ridge Ranch.
Amazing. Yeah, it's not, that is definitely in the WFMU listening area for sure. So the official story that I read is that in 1964, at age 9, you bought your first guitar at Manny's with a bag of quarters you had saved. So is it true? What kind of guitar was it, and where did you get the quarters?
Well, it's absolutely true, and I earned that bag of quarters on my newspaper route, delivering the Bergen Evening Record. On my bicycle, sometimes accompanied by our dog Joey, up until the point where he decided to irrigate my whole stack of newspapers, which I had to leave on the lawn to dry in the sun. But I still delivered them, although they were slightly yellow. But I earned a bag of quarters. I think I earned like $80 and went down to Manny's Music on 48th Street, old Music Row, and dumped them on the counter and picked out this really fine, probably Japanese brand electric guitar, and an amp, and took it home and, sat on the window ledge looking in my backyard and figuring out all these different chords.
It's 1964. I would imagine you were inspired to buy a guitar by a certain mop-topped group that invaded America. Would that be correct?
Absolutely. Like every other songwriter of that generation and subsequent generations, the Beatles were a huge influence. But also, all the stuff on the radio. I got my first transistor radio and started listening to WMCA and the Good Guys. And so everything, from the Supremes to Herman's Hermits to the Monkees to the Stones and, Dylan and of course, the Beatles. And, once you learn about three or four chords on a guitar, then you're set up to play a lot of music. So that's what I would do, sit on the steps of my basement where the acoustics were really good. There was a nice reverberation there. And, play Beatles songs and the Monkees. And, in those days, basically, as a young songwriter, aspiring songwriter, you imitate all your influences and you ape the Monkees. And then eventually I started writing some of my own songs, and I've been doing that ever since.
I think you played in, like a lot of kids, you played in, high school bands around your neighborhood or whatever the late 60s, very, very early 70s. Tell me about that scene. What was it like, and did it sort of help you build up your chops?
Well, first I played a lot of coffee houses or around the campfire at camp, strumming guitar, playing songs. Then eventually started, playing in sort of little pickup bands, doing birthday parties, and then somewhere in my high school days, started playing with a lounge band, Marcia and the Self-Portraits. Marcia was the lead singer, and she's a lovely performer, entertainer, and singer, and we did the whole circuit, weddings and bar mitzvahs and fundraisers for the Volunteer Ambulance Corps. I was always forgetting to change out of my sneakers, so I always had to stand behind my amp so no one saw me wearing sneakers, because otherwise we were relatively well-dressed. But it was fun. It was a great learning experience. And, unlike doing my own solo shows where there's an expectation that I'll be Dean Friedman performing Dean Friedman songs and an occasional cover, When you're working in a lounge band or a cover band like that, you get to be everybody. You get to be Stevie Wonder. You get to be Brian Wilson. You get to be, whoever you want as you're performing a new song and learning all about different musical idioms and styles and ways to use your voice. So it was a great learning experience.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. So I think at about age 20, you get signed to Lifesong, the record label started by the team of Cashman and West. They had produced Jim Croce. They had, their own hits. And, of course, Cashman went on to make like a whole career out of his song, Talking Baseball. How did you get signed to them? How did they find you? And am I right? You were age 20?
It's true. Well, it started out, I was in my last year attending City College, CCNY in New York. And it was a great place to study with really fine teachers. There was a vocal pop music course that I signed up for. And one of the guest lecturers was a fellow you probably recognize named David Bromberg. Who in a lot of folks' minds is considered the godfather of Americana. And he, was really open to hearing what we were doing, but I was very persistent and nudging him to get him to listen to my songs. And finally, I wore him down to the point where he decided to introduce me to the folks who then became my managers. And those were the folks that ran the Bottom Line Nightclub, which at the time was the premier showcase in New York City. And they signed me up, took me to a few producers and labels. And I got signed right off the bat by a small independent that was founded on Jim Croce's music. Lifesong Records, and they signed me, put me in the studio. The first track off the first album right out of the box was a top 20 hit, and that was Ariel, and about a pot-smoking vegetarian Jewish girl from Paramus, New Jersey. So that started things off.
Yeah, incredible. I'm interested in how the world saw what you were doing and how you yourself at that time might have described it in terms of just straight up labels. Like, what were they labeling you and what were you thinking you were doing?
Well, you know, I was just writing songs, drawing from all my disparate musical influences, which ran the gamut from Broadway musicals to classical music to rock, folk, pop, jazz, you name it. And it was all sort of combined in the songs that I was writing. And in fact, I got a lot of complaints from my various labels to the effect that they really didn't know how to describe or pigeonhole my music because it was accused of being too eclectic. And folks familiar with my albums appreciate that because, you know, there's it really runs the gamut of all those idioms that I mentioned. But for me, that was a compliment because I love all kinds of music. I was never discriminatory, except maybe against polka. But no, that's just a joke. I don't discriminate against any musical idiom because it's all, you know, great stuff. I forget who said it. Might have been Louis Armstrong or Count Basie. There's only two kinds of music. There's good music and there's bad music. So I wasn't sure how to characterize what I did, and neither did the industry. So I sort of just accepted that. The frustrating thing in some respects was that commercially, every time I put out a record that charted, because they were so unlike the rest of the fare that was on the radio, they were characterized as novelty songs. So Ariel was described as a novelty song. And Lucky Stars was described as a novelty song. McDonald's Girls was described as a novelty song. Neither of those songs are novelty songs. They were each in their own idioms and influenced by the idioms before them. But because they were so different to the radio programmer's ear, they were mischaracterized, as I see it, as novelty songs. And that was always a little bit of a frustration because, you know, they were never intended to that.
It's an interesting time, 1977, to enter the market as an artist and to try to, like, present yourself to the world and to the industry and have them focus on you, because in some ways the singer-songwriter thing was a little bit on the wane, although it never really died ever. And new wave was sort of coming in and disco was sort of coming out and bombast was, you know, there's a lot going on in terms of music changing right at that exact time. And like you said, I definitely hear all, I hear so many different things in your music. So what were the folks at Lifesong expecting? Like, you know, I wonder, well, would Jim Croce have gone new wave? You know what I mean? A couple of years later, like so many people sort of tried to do. What were they expecting from you? You know, did they discuss that with you?
Oh, they did in no uncertain terms. You know, they came from that folk country idiom and that singer-songwriter realm of solo singer-songwriters. And, you know, I, on the other hand, you know, love folk and country and Americana, but also embraced a plethora of other musical idioms and sort of merged them in a, what I think of as sort of pop fusion. Now, when my second album was delivered to the label, they called me in to their offices and they had a long sit down with me. They berated me for a good half hour to the effect that I was a bad artist. I didn't listen to anybody and I'd made a terrible record. And the reason why is because they were expecting something solo and acoustic along the lines of my first album. And you know, in the interim, I had toured with a band and was working with great New York City studio musicians and was starting to incorporate those elements into it. So when they sat me down and told me what I was doing was horrible, it really sort of underlined what I suspected all along, which is the fact that they were just clueless idiots. because I was really confident and proud of what I had done and knew it was good and was going to have a long shelf life, which it did. Fortunately, about a week after that ridiculous meeting, we got a telex. This will tell you what era that was. This is before internet. Saying that the single off the album, Wobbles to the Rocking Chair, a song called Lucky Stars, had entered the charts and was zooming up to the top. So they were just scratching their heads. They couldn't figure it out. But I'm glad I listened to my instincts and proved them wrong time and again.
Sure. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's the quirkiness and the not, you know, monolithicness of your catalog that makes you have this enduring appeal rather than, you know, it might have been a flashier thing to have remade the same album twice in a row. But of course, you now have a career because you didn't do that, which is, of course, you know, the old thing we've heard a million times. Record company people don't know anything. So let's go back to the first album for just a second. When you finished the record, were there people who were, you know, that scene that we imagine everyone sitting in the control room and, you know, the guy presses the stop button on the tape, you know, and we've all listened to the album and somebody turns to you and says, kid, Ariel is going to be a hit. You know what I mean? It's going to say, you know, on your tombstone, this guy wrote Ariel. You know, did anyone see that coming?
Well, there, you know, I never sit down to write a hit, but when I write a song that I think has that potential, it's usually pretty clear to me. And yes, it was pretty evident upon first listening that Ariel had that kind of potential. And in fact, when it was released, it suddenly became the most requested song on WNEW-FM, which at the time was the number one FM station in the country. So much that the program manager at WNEW-FM called my managers and the label to complain that all my friends were overrunning their phone lines and that I should stop having my friends call the station. And this was a shock to me because, you know, none of my friends were calling the station. It was just a natural out-of-the-box hit record, and it became more obvious as it started racing up the charts.
Yeah, it was went to number 26 on the Billboard chart and stayed on the chart for a pretty long time.
Well, the frustrating thing for me, and, you know, again, this is a sense of gradually realizing the limitations of my label and managers, is that the track Ariel kept getting bullets and jumping up the charts, but the record company, because it was small and independent, couldn't keep up with manufacturing enough singles. And so it kept climbing the charts and then it would lose its bullet and drop down because they couldn't get enough stock in the stores. And then they would catch up with the stock and then would zoom up again. So it was on the charts for a very long time, bobbing up and down like a balloon or apple in a bobbing bin. But, you know, it did the job. It sort of established me as another little potato in the vast media stew.
Yeah, I mean, I think 26 is an incredible number to, you know, just have to have a top 40 hit at all ever is amazing. But I think sometimes songs are bigger than the chart will indicate through, you know, and I think definitely Ariel is a bigger hit than that and has a longer tail than you might think from just that chart thing. So tell me on a personal level, how you were still a super young guy. How did you deal with becoming so big, so fast, traveling? Was that something easy for you, or did you, you know, lose your mind? What happened?
Well, Michael, it was all really new and exciting, but there was this constant undertow of real frustration with the circumstances, because you know, as I said a moment ago, it became quickly obvious that there were real limitations in terms of the vision that my label and management had. You know, for example, the folks who ran the Bottom Line nightclub rarely spent a minute or two out of their back offices in the Bottom Line. You know, they needed oxygen to to walk beyond the threshold to get any work done. So they were kind of perplexed when I started having hit records out of the box. Had trouble keeping up with the phenomena. I, on the other hand, was working and learning and doing my job, but still having to borrow money to get to the studio because I, in spite of having all these chart hits, I wasn't getting paid by the label. And so it became more and more obvious that something needed to change. And eventually, because they were unwilling to respect or deal directly with me as an artist, we parted ways unceremoniously.
Gotcha. One of the things about Ariel, the high notes are ridiculously high, and they're right on the money too. And this is throughout your whole catalog. I mean, did you know you could do that? Did someone coax that out of you? Where did that come from?
Probably from listening to Frankie Valli at Four Seasons Records.
Yeah.
And you know that really nice falsetto, and also I guess the Holly, someone had reviewed Ariel as by saying that Carrie Ann's little sister Ariel has grown up and is now old enough to date. So again, drawing on these disparate musical influences, and you know, my mom was a singer, and she described my voice as being a bastard tenor. I'm not quite sure what she meant, but you know, when you're singing and writing and being emotive and expressive, you sort of have a tendency to explore and experiment with your range where it is, because the edge of those ranges are where sometimes you know, interesting things happen musically. And so in Ariel, I got a chance to sit down with my first four-track TAC tape deck just to play and started harmonizing with my own voice and stacked the vocal harmonies that are in the chorus. That was the origin of that track. Again, was just playing with a multi-track tape machine. And I guess I wound up hitting those notes that somehow were in my range.
Yeah, I guess, right. You're doing harmony. Just let's try a top one. You keep trying it until you run out of range. But yes, yours is unbelievable. So you ended up putting out a second record the next year and a record in 1980. Then and your career, you've, you know, pretty much put out records evenly spaced, you know, every few years, including some kids records, some live records, some TV music, but a long wait between Rumpled Romeo and Songs for Grownups. What happened there? And I noticed that Songs for Grownups has 28 songs. So it was like, you know, you were trying to get your All Things Must Pass out of you. Was it lawsuits? What was the holdup in between?
It was just the idiocy of record labels. The lawsuits impacted it, you know, getting off Life Song Records and trying to fight for my copyrights and catalog. Certainly had an influence on that. But specifically, what happened is in 1980 or 81 around there, my third album was released and came out in the UK on Epic, part of CBS, which then became Sony. And there's a track on it that I loved called McDonald's Girl. And it's the kind of song that, you know, as soon as I wrote it, I realized this is a pure pop song and was confident that it would be a hit inevitably in its own right. And the problem is that in those days, the dominant radio format was the BBC in the UK. And that's a kind of government-controlled radio, which prohibited anything that smacked of commercialism. So, for example, the Kinks, when they put out Lola, they had to change the lyric from Coca-Cola to Cherry Cola. And similarly, Paul Simon's Kodachrome. So when McDonald's Girl came out, the first single off the third album, Rumpled Romeo, it was officially banned by the BBC. So I was in good company along with the Sex Pistols. And frustratingly, Epic lost interest and dropped me from the label. The same day they dropped about 80 other artists. It was an infamous day at CBS, Black Day at Black Rock, which is the building they used to describe. And so I was sort of left to my own devices in the wilderness. And it took about 17 years before I finally was able to get back into the studio and make a new album. But it never stopped me being a songwriter, and it never prevented me from continuing to write songs, which I did, which is why when Songs for Grownups finally came out in 98, I did have a whole bunch of songs I was real proud of, and for me was a significant return to the music business.
Yeah. Let me remind folks that Dean Friedman is our guest, and deanfriedman.com is a place you could go check for information about what Dean is up to and all this stuff we're talking about. There's a full website going on there. When you're writing songs, are you working out your problems? Are you just observing life? Is a little of both?
Well, I guess I'm one of those artists that abides that axiom to write about what you know. That's not in every instance, but for the most part, I think of what I do as sort of writing short stories set to music. And generally, the stories that I write will have to do with things that have happened in my own life or the lives of friends and family, or, you know, just the newspapers in general, the headlines and what's going on in the world. And then I also make sure to make ample use of my poetic license, which I keep in my back pocket, for those occasions where I need permission to lie and make things up. And that combination of the real world and, you know, that poetic license is what results in the songs that I write.
That's interesting. You know, I listened to you very kindly emailed me your entire catalog, and over the past couple of weeks, I've listened to every bit of it, which is, you know, not my usual, doesn't that, you know, usually happen that way, to just be able to listen chronologically to everything. And like you said, your mastery of all these different genres is in there. And you mentioned the word Broadway earlier, and there was a certain point when I was listening to all these songs that I was imagining, well, you could easily kind of link up some of these songs to the same character and watch their growth and their life and their ups and downs. Have you ever tried, or has anyone ever tried, to make these songs into a musical show?
Well, you know what, Michael? It's gratifying and equally frustrating at the same time, because almost once a month I get an email from a listener who expresses that same sentiment. And I, admittedly, you know, my mom was a performer and terrific singer and had appeared on Broadway in a Hollywood film and as a singer. So that musical world was something that always was a big influence. There's always some Broadway show tune on our piano. So the idea that there's material there that would do well on that kind of stage in that format makes a lot of sense to me and to other people. Only missing ingredients are the about $5-6 million that's required to launch a Broadway musical, even in these pandemic times. So it's still one of my unfulfilled ambitions, but I am determined one way or the other at some point to have that vision realized.
We sort of touched on this earlier, but you write and perform songs that often make people laugh. That's not the only emotion covered in your songs, but, you know, more than many songwriters, your songs evoke laughter. And there is sometimes, like you said, an interesting situation where people think you're not a serious person because, or that you're not taking your work seriously because the songs are sort of funny. And I can imagine that would be frustrating, but is that something that you ever said, I've got to not do this anymore? Like, I've got to only write songs that will never make anyone laugh?
No, I've never considered that kind of self-censorship. You know, a few things. One is that I, and maybe it's just part of my Jewish heritage, which is that I have always understood that laughter and a sense of humor is an essential ingredient to surviving in this world. And that without that ability to find some kind of funny perspective on all the insanity that is going on around us, it's hard to maintain your own sanity. So humor is always a part of what I do. As to whether I take it seriously, I would challenge anyone to to analyze the lyrics in any of my funny songs and answer the questions that those lyrics pose, because inevitably they address dead serious issues. But I try to do it in, you know, a lighthearted way, almost sort of like a Trojan horse to sneak a difficult concept into people's minds while they're laughing at something I wrote. The other thing is that, you know, among my disparate musical influences, folks like Tom Lehrer and Randy Newman, who I'm sure was influenced by Tom Lehrer, are big influences. And they took very biting satirical looks at the world around and delivered these awesome songs expressing the sentiments in a way that you really couldn't otherwise. So those were big influences, and I see threads of that influence in a lot of my work, you know, along with all the other influences, Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon, Dylan, the Beatles, James Taylor, Elton John, Bernie Taupin, Stevie Wonder, Leonard Bernstein, you name it. It's all in there somewhere, spinning around in those neurons.
Yeah, I hear all of that. You have, more than many artists, you have worldwide popularity. Was that something that just organically happened, or was that a strategy that worked out for you? How did that happen?
Michael, it was pure happenstance. It was really beyond happenstance. It was business and politics. Wherever my records have actually achieved airplay, I've had commercial success. So that's down to the competency of whatever label or promoters working for those labels were on. So, for example, Ariel was a chart record in the States that started things off. The second album became a big hit in the United Kingdom. There were some other territories I've had success in, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. You know, different territories in the Netherlands, Sweden, Norway, parts of Eastern Europe. But the main territories for me were the United States and the United Kingdom. Those were places that I was able to solidify that audience and consolidate it by touring, more so in the UK than in the US, frustratingly. From the very beginning, I toured the United Kingdom and have cultivated an audience that has stuck with me for all this time, for which I'm eminently grateful, because that audience allows me to continue doing what I do and pursuing my music.
Interesting. Yeah, it is interesting, but you know, you say that it sort of happens, but it seems like this must be something you've done to keep your interest in those places. A lot of times after a hit record, you know, you get sort of forgotten quickly.
I'll add this, Michael, is that I read an interview once with Dolly Parton and was struck by the fact that at the end of a gig, no matter how big the audience was, she stayed afterwards to sign autographs and engage her audience. And I was really impressed at that work ethic and also respect for her audience. And that's something that I always took seriously. Even during my years of the wilderness, not in the business, I made sure to put together my mailing lists and to send newsletters by post to folks who had written me and maintain that relationship. And finally, when the internet came along, it had a dramatic impact on every independent artist, because for the first time, as you know, I was able to communicate not just directly with my audience, but it was a two-way communication, which is that they would be able to communicate back to me, and we were able to have a dialogue and a conversation, which is something that I really value.
Yeah. So I do want to end this by playing the song Ariel. And one of the things I noticed is that on your own website, it says, "Sorry, this title is currently unavailable for sale or download." How is that possible?
It's possible because of the inanities of copyright law, which permit publishing companies to use and pervert the original intent of copyright law by really absconding with the most valuable asset that an artist has, which is their copyright. And so I don't own or control the copyright to the songs on my first album. But they will eventually revert back to me and in 2033. So I have the date on my calendar. That's just the nature of it. You know, I signed a bad deal with a label that was comprised of, you know, folks who claimed to do right by artists, but really didn't. They took advantage of them. And so I got the material for my second album back, the copyrights to that. Eventually I'll be able to sell and reproduce and distribute the first album as well. Again, down to bad copyright law and the abuses that the industry continues to foist on the artists that make the industry possible.
So if I want to put Ariel in a movie tomorrow, do you not benefit except for, you know, your BMI or whatever ASCAP money? Would you get zero?
I would have to find another attorney, a lawyer, to sue my record, the original record label, to be able to retrieve any of the royalties they collect on my behalf.
That's
the way the industry is structured. It's always been structured that way. Unless you have a powerful attorney and a war chest to pay them, you are pretty much at the whim of whoever executed that original deal. And you don't have a lot of options or choice starting out. There is a copyright reversion law that tries to redress some of that 35 years after the fact. And that's why 2033, I'll get those rights back. But it's not a perfect law, and it doesn't go anywhere near actually addressing the crime that these labels commit against artists. Sorry to be so impassioned, but it's a ridiculous law.
No, I've had a reversion lawyer on the show as a guest, just as kind of a public service announcement. There's this lawyer who will do your reversions for free, and if anybody is interested in that, contact me, and I'll
God bless
information. Yeah. Yeah. So Ariel, you know, infectious, quirky, irresistible and uncategorizable. But people just love the song. Have you ever done a gig post 1977 and not played this song?
Well, it's funny because in the United Kingdom, where I do most of my touring, I will sometimes perform Ariel because there it's considered sort of a turntable hit. It never charted, but it got so much airplay that people think it's a hit. In England and Scotland and Wales and Ireland. The bigger hits off of my second album are better known in the United Kingdom. That would be Lydia and Lucky Stars. Hmm. So, you know, sometimes I'm disparagingly referred to as a one-hit wonder. But the thing is, I've had those one hits be different hits in different countries all over the world. I've always taken exception to that characterization. Because when you describe an artist as a one-hit wonder, really, it's a way of describing an abusive record industry that eats its young. Because more often than not, the only reason that artist is a one-hit wonder is that something happened business-wise that prevented them from making another record. When the industry uses that term, I always want to tell them, you know what, look to yourselves as the blame for that disparaging term and find another. But listen, I'm just happy and grateful to be able to ply my musical songwriting trade for my small but very enthusiastic international audience. And invite your listeners, if you're curious, to drop by my website and or take a listen to some of the stuff on all the social media, YouTube or Bandcamp, SoundCloud. There's a lot of it out there, easy to find. Decide for yourselves.
Yeah, and folks can go to deanfriedman.com to check it all out and see the links to all that stuff. Dean, thanks so much. It's been so fascinating, and what a great glimpse into a super interesting career.
A pleasure, Mike. Thanks for having me, and look forward to hearing more of your show.
Remember the name of that hit single?
That hit single?
Yeah.
Muriel?
Muriel.
I mean, pardon me. Ariel.
Ariel.
No, I love that song. It's wonderful. That, you know, was a very exciting thing that happened. All of a sudden, it was playing on the radio in the park, just like a regular song.
That's right.
Part of the media stew. Another piece of potato.
Did that make number one?
Well, it was number one in a lot of regions. Nationally, I think it was 18.
I'm trying to get you. I'm wondering if you'd consider playing that song.
Oh, well, that's kind of rough. It's kind of, it's a piano. It's really a piano piece. It's hard to play on the guitar.
I see.
I could do, if you're really patient and bear with me, I could do a very sparse, simple version of it. I don't know how it'll come out. I'll try it for you, though.
I'm for it.
Because you were so nice and ask. Way on the other side of the Hudson, deep in the bosom of suburbia, I met a young girl, she sang mighty fine, tears on my pillow and Ave Maria. Standing by the waterfall in Paramus Park, she was working for the Friends of BAI. She was collecting cool waters in a paper cup. She was looking for change, and so was I. She was a Jewish girl, I fell in love with her. She wrote my number on the back of my hand. I called her up, I was all out of breath. I said, come hear me play in my rock and roll band. I took a shower and I put on my best blue jeans. I picked her up in my new W van. She wore a peasant blouse with nothing underneath. I said hi, she said yeah, I guess I am. Ariel, Ariel. We had a little time, we were real hungry. We went to Dairy Queen for something to eat. She had some onion rings, she had a pickle. She forgot to tell me that she didn't eat meat. I had a gig in the American Legion Hall. It was a dance for the volunteer ambulance corps. She was sitting in a corner against the wall, smiling, I melted all over the floor. Took her home with me, we watched some TV, a Funicello and some guy going steady. She's fooling around with the vertical hole. We got the munchies and I made some spaghetti. We sat and we talked into the night. Well, Channel 2 was signing off the air. I found the softness of her mouth. We made love to bombs bursting in Ariel. Ariel. Way on the other side of the Hudson, deep in the bosom of suburbia, I met a young girl, she sang mighty fine. Tears on my pillow and Ave Maria. Tears on my pillow and Ave Maria. Tears on my pillow and Ave Maria.